Bon, notre prochain orateur est professeur de technologie informatique à l'Université de Cambridge, où il dirige un groupe de recherche sur l'infographie et l'interaction. Ses recherches portent sur les moyens d'interaction entre l'humain et l'ordinateur. Alors, Pita a aussi participé récemment dans un projet de recherche avec le Faraday Institute for Science and Religion sur la science de l'épanouissement. Donc, thank you very much, Peter, for coming to speak to us today. Merci.
Hey, well, bonjour, mesdames, messieurs. Merci beaucoup pour votre aimable invitation et votre généreuse introduction. C'est un grand honneur d'être ici avec vous. Malheureusement, comme vous l'aurez compris, mon français n'est pas très bon et je suis désolé, mais il me faut continuer en anglais. Pardon. So, I am going to speak about machines in the image of man. We've just heard about man being made in the image of God, and one possibility is that men are now trying to make machines in their own image. And I want to explore some of the ideas involved from a technological perspective. I'm a technologist, I make machines. I'm particularly interested in interactions between people and machines, and this has caused us to make machines that have some human-like characteristics. And I want to explore why these aren't people. I think there's a confusion in the public mind as to what is a machine and what is a person. And we've heard some philosophical and theological discussions. I shall approach this from a technological point of view. Well, we see around us a world that is changing. People are worried because the machines might be taking over. Will they take our jobs? Possibly. Will they overpower us? Possibly. Will we have a singularity and human beings become extinct as the latest stage of evolution? Well, technology is changing our world, but I think some of these claims are a little exaggerated. And perhaps we need to think about what it is that makes us human. We've seen the development of mankind into what we are. And some people think that there's a natural progression on from this, that we shall make machines and then become machines. And is transhumanism simply another step in our evolution? Well, I don't think so. And I think if we go back to man being made in the image of God, we understand why this might not be the case. And at the creation, God created us to rule his creation and for relationships. And I'm going to talk a bit about the relationship side of this. People were created for relationships. They had relationships with each other. So God made Eve as somebody to accompany Adam, so he wouldn't be alone. It was good that there should be two of them. And people were made for relationships with God. And Adam and Eve walked in the garden, and God walked with them and came to talk to them. He unfortunately found that they had fallen to the serpent, and the story changed then. The relationship was broken, but initially people were made for relationships with each other and with God. And in part of my study about how people interact with machines, it's interesting to study how people interact with other people. And particularly, I've looked at how they do so through signals that they don't speak, through things like their facial expressions, which actually are part of our communication. It's an important part of communication. When we talk to somebody, we look at their face and we can see if they're interested or bored, confused or understanding. And we change what we're doing accordingly, what we're saying. And it's an important part of human relationships. It's something that some people can't do. People with autism spectrum conditions can't do this interpretation of other people's signs in their faces. And it puts them at a disadvantage. Well, arguably, computers ignore these signals. Computers are autistic, and I've been looking at that. And the history of this goes back a long way. Actually, it has a goes back certainly to the 19th century, when Darwin, Charles Darwin, the Cambridge scientist, working in collaboration with Guillaume Duchesne de Boulogne in Paris, thought about what it was in the facial expressions that communicated emotions. And in a book that Darwin published late in the 19th century, he talked about the expression of the emotions in man and animals. And it was an interesting book. As a scientific textbook, it sold out completely in 2 weeks, which doesn't often happen with scientific textbooks nowadays. And it used photographs. It was one of the first scientific books to use photographs. And the photographs came from Duchesne de Boulogne in Paris. Duchesne had photographed people, particularly the photographs on the very right-hand side of the screen of a tramp off the streets, and had photographed him in a neutral position at the top, and then being told a joke and laughing in the middle. And then at the bottom, Duchesne had attached electrodes to his face to make the muscles pull as if he were smiling to see if that made him happy. It didn't, but it was an interesting book and included these photographs. Well, Darwin used these photographs to try and understand if people had the same interpretation of the expressions. And what he did was what we would now call crowdsourcing. His crowds were a bit smaller. What he did was invite people round for dinner in his country house, and over drinks before dinner, he would show them Duchesne's photographs and ask them what they perceive as the emotion. And he wrote the answers down in a spreadsheet. These are the spreadsheets. These are some of the photographs. We actually have both a set of Duchesne's photographs and Darwin's spreadsheets in the University Library in Cambridge. And these are very wonderful things to see, this science from 150 years ago, almost. And the spreadsheet has the names of people down the side and the numbers of the photographs across the top. And then it says what emotion people saw. And Darwin discovered that there was a consensus view. Perhaps not the best scientific method, we would now say, but there were pictures where he saw laughter and surprise and so on. Well, we repeated this experiment a few years ago using modern crowdsourcing on the internet. We digitized the photographs, put them on the internet, and asked people what emotions they saw. And we got about 20,000 people to participate, rather more than the 20 people that Darwin asked. And we found that we got consensus as to what the emotions were in the face. And the words were slightly different because of language changes, but essentially people saw the same emotions that they'd seen 150 years earlier. So that's quite interesting. There is a common language of emotions, mental states, in the face. And of course, we know that. It's used in films. For those of you who have young children and have been to see the Disney film called Inside Out, I'm not quite sure what it was called in France, the film depicts the emotions inside a child's head. And you can see here emotions like anger and disgust and joy and fear and sadness. And these are actually five of the emotions that are commonly studied. Usually, the language that Darwin used include a sixth one, which is surprise. Apparently, you don't get surprise in Disney films. But these are still things that we react to. And film actors know about this, and they've known about it for a long time. Way back in 1909, right at the beginning of the 20th century, there was an actress in Hollywood called Florence Lawrence. She was known as the Biograph Girl. She was very famous, and she made three feature films every week. Three films every week, which is a level of productivity you don't see in Hollywood today. And the point was that then the films were only 20 minutes long, because that was as long as a roll of film, and she didn't have to learn any lines because they were silent films. So her face was very important. It conveyed emotion. And her advertising card showed this range of emotions that she could convey in her face. And it's true. It's important as a channel of communication. It enhances conversation. You can encourage people. You can show empathy. You can show sadness if they're telling you a sad story. And you can acknowledge other people by encouragement. And there are two sorts of emotions that we convey. There are what we call basic emotions, the ones that Disney discuss, anger, fear, which are very deeply innate in us. And there are then some complex mental states which reflect what you're thinking. So things like understanding and confused. And it turns out we can make machines that can, to some approximation, recognize these mental states. So we use computer vision to track someone's face. We analyze the movement of the muscles in the face. And this shows you a little program running. The bars going up and down at the bottom are showing you which muscles are acting. And these are used, something that psychologists refer to as action units. So lips pulling back, eyes open, eyes shutting. And from those, we can then make other inferences about the mental state of the person. So we're seeing words popping up. And we can also track their movements in what's called the dimensional space. So whether they're sad on one extreme through to very happy on the other, and very passive on one extreme up to very active on the other. And that turns out to work actually quite well. And the system is actually being used commercially now to measure, well, at least the happiness scale from sad to happy on people. There's a company that one of my research students is now running in America, which detects this property called valence. And they use it when they're showing audiences draft versions, early versions of television commercials, to see if they enjoy the right parts of the commercials. And this, they show the commercial to a small audience, point the camera at the audience, and see when they enjoy it. And it's also been used to monitor political debates. You can watch somebody listening to a political debate, see when they're pleased or not pleased, and that correlates with their changes in political views. So it actually is commercial. It works well enough to be commercial. And we've also been looking at it as a therapeutic tool for children with autism spectrum conditions. We had a big European project that just finished recently, where we had an adventure game, part of which was asking children with high-functioning autism, children with Asperger's syndrome, to act out different emotions. And we could monitor their faces while they were doing it and tell them how well they were acting. Because if you can learn to imitate an emotion, it actually helps you understand it when you see it in other people. So the actual tool, we would show the child a video the lady with the yellow shirt, the child, the girl with the black shirt would try and act it, and we could then tell them how their acting differed from the required action or the emotion, and seems to be of some use. Well, that's interesting. It means we can make computer systems that can understand something of the emotions in a person's face. So the other question is, can we make a machine that expresses emotions in its face? Well, for this, I had made this robot by a man in America who is very good at prosthetics. The facial texture is extraordinarily good. And inside the head, there are about 28 motors that replicate the muscles in a human face. So this robot face can very accurately portray different facial expressions. And it's really quite convincing when you look at still photographs. You could believe that those are expressions of various human emotions. It's a bit different, though, when you see it moving, and that's because we're not very good in our computer programs at controlling the motion. So here is the robot and me, as it happens, going for a car drive together, for reasons that we don't need to know, and you can see there are these movements in the face that just don't look natural. Actually, most people who have a conversation with this robot find it creepy, is the word that we usually hear. They don't like it. It's very unsettling. And that's something, I think, to do with the fact that humans, we're very good at seeing something wrong with someone's face movements. It tells us they're ill, and we just see this robot, and it's just wrong, and we think there's something, it's ill, it's unwell. And apart from anything else, when the program goes wrong, the muscles move all over the place. However, we have managed to do some good science with it. There is a medical condition called dystonia, where the patients have uncontrollable muscle movements in the face. So as you're talking to them, their face will animate in strange ways. It's very disconcerting when you first meet somebody with it. And when they're training medical students, when they meet these patients, the medical students will often show disgust because there's something wrong with this person. And it's a very bad idea if a doctor looks disgusted when they meet a patient. Well, it turns out our robot is very good at uncontrollable muscle movements. And so we got a man with dystonia who very kindly came into our lab, and we filmed him and then animated the robot using the video. And indeed, it turned out, if we exposed medical students to the robot, they could control their faces much better when they met real patients with dystonia. And that's about the only use that we've had of the robot. And actually, that wasn't that good either, because it turns out that if we showed the medical students a film of a patient with dystonia, that was just as good as well. So, in fact, the only thing that robots are good for, as far as I can make out, is publicity. And if you get a robot like this, the press will beat a path to your door. So we even got to appear on live Spanish television. We went to Spain to do it on live television because I wouldn't dare do it on television that I thought anyone I knew might watch. And we took our robot in, and it's essentially, we have a camera pointed at my face, and whatever actions I'm doing, the robot is more or less copying. And the funny thing is, it's dreadful. If you look at it, it's no use at all. But the people there so much wanted it to work that they thought it was wonderful and brilliant, and they couldn't see how bad it actually was. And that's a common thing with robots. People want to believe in them. And it's a very strange phenomenon that we've noticed. Well, this is one sort of robot, and I would suggest it's not something that's going to take over the world anytime soon. So what is actually going to happen? Well, what are robots? And robots have a long history. We heard about the electric dog from early in the 20th century this morning. Robots go back in mythology much further, of course. But I think one of the first robotic devices was this robotic monk. This dates from the 16th century. And it's about so high, about half a meter tall, and it's got mechanism within it, clockwork, so that it moves across the floor, and every half meter or so, it looks around, the mouth moves, and it raises its cross, and it beats its breast, and it plays with its rosary. So it was a monk that would say prayers for you, I think. I'm not quite sure what the theology is there. Not very good, I suspect. But it perhaps beats a monk that believes things for you. Well, that's one sort of robot. What other sorts of robots are there? Well, robots have a long history in fiction. So, again, if we move to the 20th century, one of the first works to use the word robot to mean a mechanical person was a play by the Czech playwright Karel Čapek, whose play Rossum's Universal Robots in 1920 described a company that made robots that were meant to go into service in people's houses and then took over. They were stronger and they essentially killed all the people and took over the world. That actually is a fairly ordinary story, and you'll see that occurs. Lots of robot stories are like that. In Fritz Lang's film Metropolis, there's a robot being used to deceive the workers. In modern films like Asimov's I, Robot, they, again, robots are trying to take over. But the interesting thing about Karel Čapek's film is the robots, when they take over, the robots are made very human-like. They're actually made out of flesh rather than mechanically. And the robots realize that they're different from the people. They lack the essence of humanity. And they want to know what it is because they want it. And they've kept two humans alive and asked them, what is it that makes you human that we lack? And the humans don't give an answer, so the robots try to dissect them to find out what it is, which doesn't find the answer. So that's actually quite an interesting story in that it actually asks a really good question. What is the difference between a robot and a person, a machine and a person? And the robots didn't know the answer. Now, actually, although in fiction we see lots of robots like this, most of the robots we see around us in everyday life don't actually look like people. What do they look like? Well, they look like big machines making cars in factories, making integrated circuits, doing operations on people. They're machines that are doing jobs that require strength and accuracy in the terms of making cars, delicacy and accuracy in making integrated circuits, and gentleness and human control and accuracy for robotic surgery. And so the real robots don't look like people. They're made for very particular jobs, and they do those jobs. So to think that these are going to take over the world is a little far-fetched. And I think some of the arguments about transhumanism are the same. If you ask a technologist about transhumanism, they'll probably tell you about Steve Mann at MIT, who for some years, way back in the 1990s, went around with a head-up display and television cameras strapped to him and computers strapped to himself so that he could interact with his computer and use it to process the scenes around him. Whether you call that transhumanism or not, it just seems to me it's someone who looks a little bit silly. And it's interesting that the Google glasses, which are perhaps the modern version of this, haven't actually taken off. People don't really want them. And then there are people who think that maybe they can connect themselves to the electronic world. And I guess the man who's done most of this is someone called Kevin Warwick, first at Reading University, now at a Coventry University in the UK. And he implanted a chip in his arm that can read his muscle movements. And his wife, Irina, can wear something that makes her arm feel what his arm's doing. Well, it's a gimmick. It's not really a particularly useful piece of technology. It's just a way of getting publicity. I suggest not unlike Steve Mann. But people somehow have taken this seriously and are saying that the next thing we'll have is memory transplants. Well, talking to my colleagues who are neuroscientists, they have essentially no idea how the brain works and how memory works. The idea that we can take a snapshot of our brains on a memory card and put it into some other machine to give us immortality is at best very unlikely. We really don't know enough. And in fact, the sort of transhumans that we actually see around us in everyday life are really quite boring things. They're things like artificial limbs, which are terrifically important. You have people who have mechanical parts, and with some of the exoskeletons nowadays, actually powered parts. But no one's suggesting that that's a robot. People, like me, have hearing aids because our hearing doesn't work very well. I don't think that makes me transhuman. It's just a useful piece of technology to help me. Some people even have pacemakers built into them. Well, I suppose that's transhuman. They're relying on electronics to keep them alive, but it's hardly going to make them a different species, and it certainly won't be passed on to other generations. So I suspect that a lot of the transhumanism talk is very far away from the practicalities of what actually is likely to happen. We will have medical interventions of one sort or another that help people, but they're not something that we will pass on genetically to our successors. It's just something that helps us in our everyday life. Now, actually, if we go back to the robot systems, the sorts of robots that really worry me a lot are the sort of robots that we don't see around us in the world. So there are things like the mobile phone system that we all use. Well, that's an incredibly complicated electronic system. But actually, it knows an awful lot about us. It knows where we are. It knows who we've communicated with. It's a crucial system for surveillance. And perhaps we don't think of it like that, but we maybe ought to. It maybe does worry me. We have global positioning systems, which we rely on when we drive our cars, find our way to remote parts of foreign countries. And we have automatic trading systems in our banks where the computers are making decisions about which stocks to buy and to sell. Now, these are the real robots in the world around us, and arguably, they're really quite dangerous. The surveillance that's given by mobile phones is dangerous. The way that GPS can control things, very useful, but very dangerous if it were to break. Financial trading systems increase profits, but they're very dangerous. If they go wrong, and arguably they did in 2008, it can actually lead to the stock market crash. So there are things about these robots that really worry me. And we don't see them. They're just there, built into the world around us. And now, of course, there are other robots that worry me a bit. Perhaps increasingly, I'm worried about military robots. Now, some robots are just things that go and help with defusing bombs. Well, that's good. If a robot gets blown up, it's not so much of a problem as the person gets blown up. So that's good if we can send a robot in. And we have walking robots that can perhaps carry people, injured people off battlefields. Well, that seems like quite a good thing too. We then get a little bit more difficult where we have robots that are actually being used as military weapons. And of course, I'm thinking of drones here. Drones allow us to originally to monitor remote sites without running any risks. They just remote-controlled aeroplanes. And then they were armed with missiles, and we have remote-controlled weapons. And I worry a bit about that, because military commanders are trained in the law that governs the way we conduct warfare. They know that there are rules about what they're allowed to do and what they mustn't do. But the people who are controlling these drones are nowhere near the battlefield. They're in a bunker in the middle of America, flying the drones and launching the missiles. And it looks too much like an arcade game. They don't think of it as real life. And that is worrying. That's worrying. And what's even more worrying is the suggestion that the robots could be made autonomous. The drones could be autonomous. They could identify targets themselves. They could be programmed with the rules of engagement and launch missiles. And that worries me a great deal, because I think my knowledge of computers is such that I know we make mistakes writing computer programs. And making mistakes when you write a lethal machine is not a good idea. And there have been mistakes in some medical equipment, and people have died. And that's very sad. I think these remote control or autonomous weapons have the capacity to do much more damage, and we need to be very careful about allowing ourselves to go along those lines. But meanwhile, the robots that we actually seem to have around us in everyday life are essentially toys. We have robot vacuum cleaners that tidy up our floors. Well, that's fine. They're not very good at it, actually, but they're quite fun to watch. We have robots that serve drinks in a bar. The Japanese seem very keen on having robots do things like this, and so they develop robots that bring you drinks. Well, it's a pretty inefficient way of serving a meal in a restaurant. I have to say, the joy for me of coming to Paris is to eat in a small family restaurant where I meet the patron, his wife, and we chat together while we're eating. That is what I think eating out is like, and having a robot spill a drink on me won't be as much fun. And as I say, people think that maybe robots should conduct marriages, and again, the Japanese really like this, the idea that you have a little robot that somehow marries you. Very curious, you'll see that some of these are beginning, the robots are beginning to look like people again. And, well, these are just toys, really, so I don't think we need to worry about them. We might need to worry about the people who take them seriously. There are some robots that, like this, that we do need to worry about. There is now, as always with technology, I'm afraid, it's what happens with video recording, and it's what happens with the internet, and that is that sex is the main use, and of course there are now sex robots. And that tells us actually something about people and the fallen nature of people, that they can somehow think that a relationship, if that's what it is, with a machine, is in some sense a substitute for a real relationship with a person. There are very odd things, but it tells us about the human condition. And not, I think, something that that's a major concern for the future of humanity. So what are the ethical implications? Well, a lot of people, and this is, I think, believe the fiction too much. They think that because a robot has mechanical parts that replicate some sort of human movement, and it has monitors that monitor the humans, looks at their face, expresses faces, it's somehow sentient, it's thinking. Well, of course it isn't. It's just a simulation, and it's very important to remember when what we're seeing is a simulation and not the real thing. And if we think of machines as people, people are even talking about robot rights, whether the robot actually deserves some protection in the way that people are protected, I heard a bizarre question being asked that if robots can be ordained as priests, can they baptize people? Well, that's just a weird question because it shows such a misunderstanding of what a pastor does and what baptism is about. But actually, it just tells you that the people asking the question have a very poor understanding of their theology. But there are ethical issues with robots, and they're the same as any other profession. There's the issue of the motivation. What do people want to do? Do they want to help people? Prosthetic limbs, hearing aids, heart pacemakers. That's good ethical things to do. That's a fine motivation. Making war, less good. Taking money off people because of their base nature, less good. And we need to worry about competence. And we need to worry about whether they do it well. We need to know if the heart pacemaker is going to work properly. Is it secure? Can it be taken over by somebody with a mobile phone and turned off by somebody next to you on the metro? This would be a bad thing, but that's not a robot taking over, it's just incompetent programming of the pacemaker. Likewise, the trading systems or the weapons. So I think motivation and competence are the issues that we need to understand, and they're human issues. And to think of machines, robots, as if they were people, is just a misunderstanding. And of course, the misunderstanding is been around for a long time. Alan Turing, who was a popular figure, I suppose, much more highly regarded after he died than before, thought of this idea that maybe machines would become indistinguishable from people. And he devised a test that might allow you to distinguish them, called the imitation game. And roughly speaking, you had to identify by pure text communication, something called a teleprinter, think of it as being like a text message, a short message, you had to communicate with a person and with a machine and try to understand which was the person, which was the machine. And he thought, well, one thing would be arithmetic. The machine would do arithmetic faster than a person. Maybe you could play chess against it, and the computer might be better at chess. Maybe you could ask it to write poetry. Actually, that's beginning to get interesting, because of course computers do write poetry nowadays. It's not very good. You can usually tell which is human and which is machine poetry. Very interesting that that Turing, a mathematician, and a man, it has to be said, who was probably some way on the autism spectrum, didn't think about facial expressions. He didn't think about tone of voice. He didn't think about body posture and gesture. He didn't really think about the signals that make us human. And they are perhaps a more useful. Thank you very much. He didn't really ask the right questions about how we can tell whether it's a machine or a person. So I come back to where I started. The difference between people and machines is that people were made for relations. And we've broken those relationships with each other and particularly with God. And this is seen as the main theme in the New Testament. It's about repairing that broken relationship, the relationship that was broken in the Garden of Eden. And we read that God's eternal qualities have been clearly seen, and they were understood from what he's made. So there was no excuse for people separating themselves from God, because people knew God, but they didn't glorify him, give thanks for him, and their thinking was futile and foolish. Well, I'd suggest that's what people are doing when they think that robots might have a relationship like that. They won't. And we have to think to our Creator to understand the real relationship. So why are we fascinated by robots? Why do we think that they might supersede us? They're not. And what do we mean by the image of man? Well, the image, if we go back to Genesis, is what God made man in his own image. What do we know of God at that point? He is a creator. He ruled the world. And he judged the world. God, after each day of creation, God looked at what he'd made and said it was good. So the role of being in God's image is not some facial resemblance, but it's those same activities of ruling and particularly relationships. And our robots are a poor physical representation of people. We don't really have a relationship with them. And even a robot that can recognize emotions and display emotions, it doesn't have empathy. It's a simulation. A person that could recognize and display emotions without understanding them would be called a psychopath. And it's a problem. It's not sentient. And there is no spiritual element to our relationship with robots. And that seems to me the thing that will make them always different from people. There's no mechanism for evolution. We're not going to find that robots evolve and pass genetics on to their successors. We can create robots, but our relationship with them is very different from God's relationship with us. We can make robots, we can make them look like us, but the relationship we have with them is quite different from the relationship that God has with us. And if we think about what it is that makes us human, it is this business of being made in the image of God, as our second speaker was saying. And when, perhaps going back to the first talk, one of the ideas of the Tower of Babel was to reach up to God. And, of course, mankind has been trying to reach up to God ever since the fall. The Tower of Babel was a physical representation. Perhaps more recently we would think that salvation through works, having to do the right works, say the right number of prayers, do various penances, these are what rebuild your relationship with God. And of course that's wrong. The way that God restored his relationship with us was not by us climbing up to God, but by God coming down to us in the form of Jesus. He made us to rule the world. We've failed. We've broken that rule. He made us for relationships with each other and with God, but we've broken those relationships. And the way that God wanted to restore the relationships was by sending Jesus down to us. We couldn't reach up to heaven. He had to come down. And that is the one fixed point in all of this changing, that we are fallen people, and God loved us enough that he sent his son to give us eternal life. And we're a long way from building machines that we would have that sort of relationship with. I love my son, but I'm not going to sacrifice him to save one of my robots. I quite like my robots, they're rather fun, but it doesn't matter. And if we think about the way we look after people, our relationships with people work, I have a relationship with my smartphone, has to be said. I saw when you were asked to turn your smartphones off at the beginning how sad you all looked. You were going to be separated from your companion for 2 hours. And I like my smartphone. I rely on it. But if it's not got enough memory for the latest apps, or if its screen gets broken, well, I just throw it away and get another one. I don't have much of a relationship with it. But with a person, if they become deaf, we give them a hearing aid. If they their body begins to break and they need a heart pacemaker, we put a heart pacemaker in. We care for them enough. Even if they get old and their mind goes and we can't prepare the mind, we still love them and care for them. We have a relationship with people, and we have that relationship with our children, and we don't have that relationship with machines. And so it is in the extreme case that God had a relationship with us, which is quite different from the relationship that we have with machines. And I think if we confuse ourselves and think that robots are going to take over, we misunderstand our place in creation. Well, that might be a good point to start our discussion. I'll just finish by saying, of course, I don't really do much of this work. I have a large team of people over the years who've done all the science, and I just come here and tell you about it. But thank you very much.
Merci beaucoup, Peter. On a le temps pour une question maintenant, et après on va poursuivre cet après-midi avec la table ronde. Et il y aura aussi un groupe de discussion avec les orateurs, donc un en anglais avec Peter pour ceux qui veulent savoir plus. Mais on a le temps pour une question.
Dans votre intervention, je pense à un essayiste, alors je le dis en français, vous le traduirez en anglais, merci beaucoup. Je pense à un essayiste, Paul Virolio, que vous connaissez peut-être, qui est urbaniste, et qui dit que finalement, le problème ou la problématique est posée avec la robotique, ce n'est pas l'homme sans le robot, ou c'est pas le robot sans l'homme, ce n'est pas le robot contre l'homme, c'est l'homme qui avale le robot. Et je vais expliquer la suite, je vous laisse traduire.
Donc il avale le robot, c'est ça?
Oui. Ce n'est pas le robot contre l'homme, ce n'est pas le robot sans l'homme, c'est l'homme qui avale le robot. Alors, il évoquait là la dimension de la nanotechnologie. Et vous ne l'avez pas évoqué. C'est-à-dire que l'enjeu étant pour l'humain, finalement, de performer, d'augmenter finalement ses compétences cognitives, ses performances sur le plan physique, c'est au fond l'homme qui devient lui-même son objet, qui est la dimension de la nouvelle robotique.
So I think the question is, will technology enhance us, and it might prolong our lives? And of course, people like Ray Kurzweil do talk about people being alive today who will never die, because the technology will be extending life expectancy by more than a year per year, as it were. Well, I think my answer to that is it shows a terrible lack of ambition. There is a better place than this world, and actually wanting to live forever is a really bad idea. It just seems such a strange misunderstanding of what God has created for us. I also suspect, and I've watched people growing old. My father was 97 when he died, and he was happy to die. He knew there was a better place to go, and a lot of technology kept him alive that long, and that was good for many years. I could have conversations with him, so that does all help. But I don't think it's making us a different species. I just think that's the same thing as the hearing aid or the heart pacemaker. It's just another version of that. And we shouldn't want to live forever. I don't think we're going to be able to extract our minds and put those into some permanent state. And of course, it's also absolutely not something we can pass on genetically. Apart from anything else, the time when we have the implants will probably pass reproductive age, so it's not going to actually happen. So these are prosthetics. It's not a different generation of people. The people will eventually die, and the prosthetics will be used for it.